Hello, welcome to the podcast. You're listening to Rabbi Danny Eisenberg, and happy Chanukah to those who are listening on Chanukah itself. I'd like to discuss the festival of Chanukah, and in particular, what I would like to discuss is when it comes to other festivals, we say that the concept of having a festival is not merely to remember what happened in the past. Pesach is not merely about remembering the Exodus, but rather it's to relive the Exodus. In other words, each and every year we need to go through the experience of having the Seder to reenact and to relive the concept of Exodus, because it continues to build us as a nation. Each and every year we need to be rebuilt. We need to revisit our origins in order to be rebuilt as a nation. Now, when it comes to Chanukah, the normal explanation as to why we celebrate it is because Hashem performed miracles for us. First of all, there was the miraculous salvation that carried out by the Maccabees, through the Maccabees, against the Greeks, when they were far outnumbered, and here Hashem allowed the Maccabees to overcome the Greeks. And second of all, there was the miracle of the Pach HaShemen, of the flask of oil that should have only burned for one day, but in fact burned for 8 days. So we have these miracles that Hashem performed for us, and on the basis of these, Hashem, the Chachamim, came and they established a festival that we celebrate annually. Now the question is, though, is it more than that? Meaning, is there something about the events behind the Chanukah that we actually not just commemorate, but we actually have to relive, that we have to go through and are part of the building of who we are as a nation? That is the question. So, with regard to this concept, I actually heard an interesting insight from one of my Rabbonim, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein, Rosh Yeshiva of Rav Yeshivat Har Tzion, the Gush, and he points out that the events of Chanukah actually are not merely one event of salvation and a miracle that took place, but they actually represent a watershed in Jewish history, because the struggle that the Jews had with the Greeks was the first time that the Jewish people actually confronted a culture which was more sophisticated, more advanced, or not more advanced, but highly advanced. Essentially, when the Jews had to deal with foreign cultures in the past, they had to deal with idolatry, paganism, they had to deal with essentially, you know, cave people, people who were not very advanced, the beginnings of civilization, people who the essential nature of their worship was very, very primitive. And therefore, the Jews, unfortunately, sometimes succumbed to temptation to engage in their primitive worship, partially because it had certain hedonistic elements to it. But they were never, on an intellectual level, really challenged, really placed in a position of compromise vis-a-vis the intellectual caliber or the cultural value behind these cultures. These were primitive cultures, but when the Greeks came along, so essentially the Jews were now confronted by a very sophisticated culture. Here you had the Greeks with their tremendous advances in science, in literature, in architecture, the aesthetics, in philosophy, you know, all kinds of areas. And the actual struggle here was not only with the Greeks, between the Greeks and the Jews, but really between the Hellenists and the Jews. Jews who had adopted for themselves Greek culture, who had said, reached the conclusion that now we were living in a modern era, and it was time to embrace modernity, it was time to put aside traditions that came from the past, that were based on our primitive origins, and it was now time to welcome the dawning of a new era. This really was the struggle that the Jews faced with the Greeks and with Hellenism at the time of the Maccabim. And it's interesting because throughout history, this is not a struggle that has happened to us since then just once, meaning the Greeks were perhaps the first time that we had to confront this kind of challenge. But ever since, time and again, we find ourselves confronting a similar challenge. It was after the Greeks came the Romans. They again presented themselves as the new movement on the block, so to speak. They were the new modern world, and everybody else had to justify themselves their continued independence to explain why they don't simply just adopt the ways of the Roman Empire. Then the Jews had it again when it came to Christianity. The Christians came along and wanted to say that in terms of their spiritual heritage, they had now come across a new form of spirituality which superseded the previous covenant that God had with the Jewish people. Now it was time to sort of adopt the religion of love, so to speak, and approach their form of relationship with God, which was not just the God of the Father, as they called Hashem in the Jewish context, but also their own form of Trinity relationship with God. So here you had it again, and the Jews were again confronted with people saying that a new era has dawned. Later on, much later on, we faced it with the Enlightenment, where a new movement of intellectuals came along and said that we should understand society, we should develop society based on the faculty of reason, not on the basis of tradition, on the basis of previously held beliefs, but rather we should work it out all again. And once again we had a movement which was challenging the value of Jewish tradition. Then we've experienced it since. We had the communism coming along in the early 20th century, which again wanted to suggest that the ways of Judaism had been superseded, and now we were going to create a new society based on a different model that would be more fair and more equitable. So time and again the Jews have been confronted by these challenges, where they're presented as thinking in outdated ways, in our old-fashioned ways, and there is a much more advanced and profound new reality that is beginning to dawn. Now, in a sense, the fact that the Jewish people have lived so long and we have seen all of this happening really strengthens us, because we've seen that these nations come along. Everyone thinks, we're modern, we're new, we're the best, and from now on, the world will never be the same again. Now, it's true, perhaps, that certain contributions that have been made by this society are still with us, the Greeks. Their contribution to architecture, their contribution to philosophy is still, on some level, significant. But in many respects, we've seen that these empires rise and then eventually they fall. They have their moment in the sun, even that can last even hundreds and occasionally over 1,000 years. But eventually these movements fall, and essentially they have this inflated pride that makes them think that they are the last word on everything. This is the problem that we face, but we, in a sense, we have grown used to that. So in a sense we can say that we have been insulated against this threat, because in the future when someone new comes along and says, for example, circumcision is really primitive and it's out of date, so we can say, well, you know, the Greeks tried to ban circumcision, the Romans made a mockery of circumcision. We've had these kinds of arguments before. In the end, we're not particularly impressed by the fact that, you know, you come along with your claims of being super advanced. We've dealt with this before, and we're going to hold on to the ways of our forefathers, whether we understand it or not. In the case of circumcision, there's an element of chok involved, perhaps, why it is that we have a chok. But at the end of the day, we're still around. Movements like you have come and gone, and we're not going to allow ourselves to be intimidated by this kind of thinking. So in a sense, what we can say is this is the legacy, the ongoing legacy of Hanukkah, in a sense that it brings to the fore this concept that the Jews have had to confront various societies with their alternative cultures, and it's difficult, in a sense, to maintain your integrity and your commitment to your existing tradition, because it's looked down upon. But nevertheless, we've been able to do it, and we're still here, and those nations are no longer. Now, when it comes to the Maccabees themselves, their achievement was all the more impressive because they didn't have a history to rely upon, meaning they did not see this happen time and time again throughout history the way we have. For them, it was happening for the first time, and yet they stayed to remain strong and maintain their faith in the fact that ultimately they'd be vindicated, and Hashem showed them that this was in fact the case. Hashem, through the miracles that he performed for them, he showed them that they're on the true path and they don't have anything to be intimidated about, And this was an inspiration, has been an inspiration for future generations. This, in fact, is part of the legacy that we continue when we celebrate Hanukkah each and every year. We show that this message of the truth of our path, the commitment and the justification of our path, this is something that we should hold, we should remain strong about, we should continue to maintain our commitment in the face of whatever pressure the nations of the world bring to bear upon us. Now, based on the idea that I've just shared, we can perhaps explain one of the mysterious, enigmatic details in the laws of Hanukkah that's discussed in the Gemara. As you're probably aware, there are two different opinions as to how we should fulfill the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles in the best possible way, mihadrin min mahadrin. According to Beit Hillel, we light the candles in ascending order, meaning we start with one candle on day one, and increased it on day two to two candles, etc. By the end of Hanukkah, we're lighting eight candles. The Gemara mentions the opinion of Beit Shammai that says that you should light in descending number, starting with eight candles on day one, seven candles on day two, etc., down to one. Now, the Gemara mentions two different opinions as to what this debate is about. According to one of the versions, we'll discuss one of the versions, which says that Beit Hillel's reasoning is based on the principle of Malin Bakodesh Lo Moridin. We increase the number of candles because in general in Judaism we try to increase in sanctity and not to decrease. You should always try and elevate things to a higher level, and therefore it's desirable. Hanukkah represents this idea that we should increase light in the world and not decrease light in the world. What's the rationale of Beit Shammai? After all, Beit Hillel's reasoning is very reasonable. Beit Shammai's reasoning, the Gemara says, brings the opinion that it's Keneged Parei HaChag. It corresponds to the bull offerings that the Jews would offer in the Beit HaMikdash on the festival of Sukkot, where they would start out on day one offering 13 bull offerings, and the number would descend by one each and every day. So you'd have 12 bull offerings on the second day, 11 on the third, going down to 7 on the final day of Sukkot. So therefore, on the basis of this model of descending order, says Beit Shammai, we should have a descending order on when it comes to the Hanukkah candles. This is very strange, because what does the number of bull offerings that we offer in Sukkot have to do with Hanukkah? You know, what does that have to do with the price of fish in China? It seems to be totally random and disconnected. So there's different responses to this question. What's the relationship? Is there a relationship between Hanukkah and Purim? Between Sukkot and Hanukkah. There are those who discuss such a connection. But I would like to take a slightly different approach to that and mention that Rashi, in his commentary on the Chumash, he explains what's the symbolism behind this idea of the bull offerings descending in order on the festival of Sukkot. And he says like this. He says that on Sukkot, so we're bringing these bull offerings not just for ourselves, for our own benefit, but also to bring bracha, to bring blessing for the entire world. Why? Because on Sukkot, Hashem judges the world with regard to rainfall. He determines how much rain and the quality of the rain that should fall in the coming year based on his judgment at the time of Sukkot. So therefore we are required to bring, the Jewish people bring in the totality, when you add up the 13 plus 12 plus 11 plus 10, etc., bull offerings throughout Sukkot, you bring a total of 70 offerings, 70 korbanot, and these correspond to the 70 nations of the world. In other words, we are serving in the Beit HaMikdash not just for our own benefit, but also for the benefit of the nations of the world. We are, in that sense, Mamlechet Kohanim, we are a kingdom of priests for the entire world. Through us, all the nations of the world shall be blessed, as Hashem promised Avraham. So that's our role. However, why the descending order? Rashi explains that this idea represents the notion that the nations of the world will end up decreasing at a certain level. They shall converge towards nothingness. Now, what does this mean exactly? Does this mean that the world will only have Jews? There won't be any Goyim anymore? Is that what we're saying? Well, it seems that the idea is this. At this point in time, the world, the nations of the world, all have different agendas. Each nation has its own unique agenda that it pursues, and which may or may not fit with the agendas of other nations. Is this the ultimate goal? Is this the way the world should run? No, ultimately the entire world should all be serving Hashem. Each nation perhaps in its own way, but as we say on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, V'yasuchu l'am aguda achat, la'asar tzoncha b'lev Hashem. That all the nations of the world should become one grouping, one entity, all serving Hashem with a full heart. This is the goal. So the idea here, when we talk about the reduction in the nations of the world, we're not talking about necessarily that the nations of the world are going to disappear, but in a sense the divisions between mankind are going to disappear. Ultimately we're leading to the world towards a realm of achdut, of unity, where we're all pursuing a common agenda of serving Hashem. So based on this concept, we can explain as follows, that really when we talk about the miracle of Hanukkah, what does it symbolize for us? It symbolizes the idea that the Jewish people can see that even though at this point in time their views are not necessarily subscribed to by other nations, the rest of the world doesn't appreciate what we stand for, but ultimately we have confidence that the rest of the world will come to see things in our way, even though at this point in time they think their way is more advanced and our way is essentially old-fashioned and outdated. We have confidence in the fact that Bayomahu Yashem Echad Ushmo Echad, one day Hashem will be one and His name will be one. In other words, His name will be recognized by everybody, and the mitzvot that we've been keeping all of this time, even though we can't necessarily explain them to the world now, but ultimately, and even though the world may reject them or question them or challenge them and undermine them, but ultimately they will see the wisdom of it and ultimately they will come to appreciate it. And this is the concept expressed perhaps by Beit Shammai, even though we don't practice follow the opinion of Beit Shammai lahalacha, we follow the opinion of Beit Hillel in the way we fulfill the mitzvah, but that's only because you can only do one, you can't do both, so therefore we practice it like Beit Hillel, but the value, the principle behind Beit Shammai's opinion is still correct. This idea that we have, that our underlying emunah, that our ways shall be vindicated, that is something that is still eminently true. So this is a central message here that we've made, that the idea is, it doesn't matter in our confrontation with the nations of the world, it doesn't really matter whether they accept what we think or not. We should be confident, we should know that we have always been on the other side of the river, so to speak. We are the descendants of Avraham HaIvri. Of Avraham, he was called the Hebrew. Why the Hebrew? Because he crossed from the other side of the river, the river Euphrates. He came from the other side of the river. But Chazal tell us it wasn't just that he geographically came from the other side of the river. It was as if he was standing on one side of the river, the entire rest of the world was standing on the other side of the river. He held a view that was antithetical to the idolatrous views of the entire world at his time. And they did not understand his view at all, but he nevertheless held strong. He had confidence that he was right, and that ultimately the world would see things his way. And this is how it's been our experience throughout history, that we have been mocked, we've been criticized, we've been misunderstood, but over time, slowly, the world has come to respect us and has come to see that our ways actually have tremendous merit. They have adopted many of our values. These have become centerpieces in the Western way of life, in the Western thought, and we have nothing to be embarrassed about, and even if there are limitations to this, to the extent that they don't fully understand some aspects of what we stand for, nevertheless we can be confident that Bayomahu Yashem Echad Ushmo Echad, that the world will move towards an ultimate unity where they will appreciate what we do, they will understand what we're about, and we don't have to shift in our ways and feel pressured or feel uncomfortable in any respect about what we're about. We just have to be strong. We have to take the lesson from the Hashmonaim, from the Maccabim, that stood their ground and understood, had confidence in what they were about. Wishing you all a Chanukah Sameach.